Your conference is being recorded.
Good afternoon and welcome to the BOK Financial Trust Education Program. We've created this program to support the RIA community and area of trust as we develop relationships with our advisor-friendly trust services. Next month, join us on May 24th for our session focused on advising business owners for their business planning aligned with their estate planning. And our speaker is Jerry Bell of the Bell Law Firm in the Kansas City area. As you're aware, each program has a professional presenter discussing an aspect of trust and estate planning specifically geared toward the advisor community. And, of course, if you have any suggestions on future speakers, specific content, or any other general comments to improve our program, we'd love to hear them. We're pleased to have several of our markets participating in today's presentation. And as a housekeeping issue, this call will be recorded for future use. So please, if you're not located here in Kansas City, put your phone on mute and we'll minimize the background noise. If you do have any state-specific questions, please feel free to ask your host or your local trust manager to address them. If time permits, we'll address at the end of the session today. This, as well as our future programs, is approved for 1.5 hours of continuing education credit. So please make sure you sign in and we'll electronically submit your credits for you. Please know from time to time the CFP board does skip a few entries, so if you're expecting something on your recorded sessions for education, it's not showing up, just let us know. We'll take care of that for you. Today, our presenter is a friend of BOK Financial in the Kansas City area, Alice Hasseltein, and our topic is on estate planning for digital assets. What happens when you've logged off for the final time? If you do have any questions, please feel free to hold on to them at the end of the presentation. Alice will provide us time to address those questions. So let me tell you a little bit more about our speaker today. Alice is an attorney at Kirkland, Woods, and Martinson here in Kansas City. She works with individual clients in the preparation of wills, durable power of attorney, revocable and irrevocable trusts, and is experienced advising clients in areas of transfer trust planning and business succession planning. She also advises fiduciaries in trust and probate administration matters, and Alice is a frequent presenter on estate planning and estate and trust administration issues. She earned her BA from University of Virginia and her JD from University of Missouri, where she was inducted into the order of, she was also induced there. We're pleased to have you involved in our trust education program today. Now I'll go ahead and turn it over to Alice. And thank you very much, Alice, for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I'll start the presentation by acknowledging something that I'm sure all of you already know, and that's that our lives are increasingly digitalized. Statistics show that the way that we're living our lives, both personally and also professionally, is evolving quickly with a clear shift towards the Internet. According to a recent McCaffey survey, the average person has more than $55,000 in digital assets. Most individuals have in excess of 30 passwords, and there are more than 30 million Facebook accounts out there that are looming around that belong to dead people. So this is the status quo, and think about how quickly this is changing and where we'll be in 3 years, 5 years, many, many years when you all and when our when my clients, me, when we become incapacitated and die. So the impact of this shift to a digitalized lifestyle can really be experienced when a loved one becomes incapacitated or dies. So as an estate planner, estate planners really need to approach this issue from two different sides. First, we need to provide for the disposition of digital assets in an estate plan. And then secondly, we need to provide very clear instructions to fiduciaries about how to access digital assets. And as the number and complexity and value of all of these assets continues to increase steeply, all of the questions about how we administer these assets and how we administer them well continues to increase as well. So I will start by giving you an overview of what we're going to talk about today during the presentation. First, we'll talk about just really generally what is a digital asset, what is this very broad group of the type of property that we're planning for, and also why do we care so much about it and why does it need to be a part of a comprehensive estate plan. Next, we will talk about various issues that make the digital asset issue complex. What we will find and what I will describe to you is that this is an area where we have federal laws, state laws, contracts that users are entering with providers, which we call terms of service agreements. All of these things are interacting and giving fiduciaries conflicting instructions about how to marshal and control and protect these things. And I should say here, when I use fiduciary in this context and throughout this presentation, there are lots of different types of fiduciaries, but I'm generally talking about trustees under a trust agreement, personal representatives under a will, agents under a power of attorney. Those are the general fiduciaries that I'm referring to here. Next, I will mention some estate planning strategies that we engage in with clients, what we think are some best practices for planning for this digital asset issue. Next, I'll talk about RFATA. That is the Revised Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. Definitely a mouthful. I will abbreviate it as RFATA. And then lastly, we'll talk about a few administration issues related to digital property. And so that's what I'm talking about there is when we have digital assets in an estate, what are some of the issues that come up there and how do we handle that? So moving on to the next slide, what is digital property? And most simply, digital assets are electronic records in which someone has a right or an interest. And this is a really, really broad and diverse category of property. And it's constantly evolving and changing as new technologies are developed. So it includes things like information that's stored on a computer or other digital device. It includes all content that's been uploaded to the internet, so that could be in the form of blogs or information that's uploaded to a portal. And it includes rights to digital property records that are either the catalog or content of electronic communication. So later in the presentation when I talk about some of the laws that control in this area, and especially with respect to the uniform law that I'll talk about, we will find that the laws are drawing a distinction between the content of electronic communications and at the catalog of an electronic communication. And just really briefly, content is things like the text in your text messages, subject lines of emails, the bodies, things like that. A catalog of an electronic communication might be a date stamp of when a message was sent, or the code that is associated with who received that message, so kind of that hard data, so to speak. And I should also mention, a digital asset, the definition of digital asset does not include the underlying asset. So by that I mean a wiped iPhone is not that's tangible personal property and treated differently for all of these purposes. But really, understanding digital property is the best way to understand it is to go through examples. So probably the most common type of digital property that we see, that I see at least, that we're administering, needing to account for are frequent flyer points, hotel points, mileage points, those types of things. This includes email accounts, social networking accounts like Twitter and Facebook. It's voicemail accounts, it's all online photos and videos, and then the forums that we have for sharing those, like Instagram and YouTube. It's all of the financial information accounts that our clients have, web pages, blogs, video blogs, online purchasing accounts like Amazon, domain names are included in this. There's also a lot of value associated with online gaming. And then we also have Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So very generally, a cryptocurrency is a digital or virtual currency that uses cryptography as security. And the defining feature of these types of cryptocurrency is that they're not issued by a central authority. And that poses a lot of really complicated administration issues. So I plan to talk a little bit more about Bitcoin later in the presentation, but Bitcoin is really just one type of cryptocurrency. There's also altcoin and Dash and a few other things that we sometimes encounter. So really, digital property, all of these things I've mentioned, and then it's the passwords associated with all of these different accounts and other encryption. And then, as I mentioned before, this definition includes all of the technology that our clients that doesn't exist yet, but will during this window of time before they become incapacitated or pass away. Why as an estate planner are we thinking and talking about digital assets, and why do we care? And really, probably the most fundamental reason that it's something that we need to address as a part of an estate plan is that our clients really care about this property. So digital assets in many cases have tremendous sentimental value. And today the photos and the videos and even recipes are being kept online. And these things are really replacing the albums and the journals and the recipe boxes that have, been passed down from generation to generation. So in an instance where a fiduciary, in often case children or can't access the MacBook Pro that their parents used and kept all their photos on, then that information is lost. So, and oftentimes planning is about the fact that this is important to many people. Additionally, sometimes this property has real financial value. One anecdote that I encountered kind of in preparing and reading about some of this is that recently, I think it was in 2015, a piece of digital real estate sold for $2.5 million. So that's kind of a hyperbolic example, I guess, and I certainly didn't do the estate planning for that client, for that person. But there are instances where we encounter digital assets with real financial value. And then lastly, securing this property helps protect our client's identity while they're incapacitated and upon their death. And in a recent 2-year period, the number of Americans who had their identity stolen under these circumstances exceeded 10 million, and the financial losses associated with these thefts exceeded $15 billion. So this is a targeted group of people, and oftentimes when someone becomes incapacitated or passed away, that that presence or lack thereof is really easily discernible on social networking and other sites. So it's easy for people to target people in this way. So oftentimes, the planning that we're doing is aimed at giving fiduciaries the power to kind of step in and close down accounts and really just make sure that no other financial data is jeopardized. So moving forward, now we'll talk about what makes the digital property issue so complex. I already alluded to this at the beginning of the presentation. Perhaps one thing worth noting off the bat is just the baseline. One thing that makes this complicated is technology itself. A perfect anecdote of that is the trouble of getting basic technology to work routinely, and there are always glitches, and it's a challenge. So even if somebody has all of the estate planning in line and has consents and everything pans out, if a fiduciary doesn't have the password, or more likely if there's some other type of higher or more sophisticated password protection in place, which we're seeing as a place like, you know, face screens and things of that nature, then there's a real technical lockout, and all of the planning could be for naught. So, but we'll start with talking kind of about the law. If you review the law in this area, you'll find that a lot of it is unsettled. Missouri is one of the states in the United States that doesn't have clear statutory authority that gives fiduciaries the authority to carry out his or her duties to control and to control digital assets. So there's no clear statutory authority, and then as we'll talk about with federal law, there are multiple instances where federal law actually provides that it's a federal crime to step in and access information as if you were the original user. So talking about federal law generally, I mean, there are a lot of different areas that are intersecting here when we talk about digital assets. So there's federal copyright law, trademark law. Those aren't really things I'm going to cover here. There are federal transfer tax laws that are playing and have a an effect on this area. But really, there are two federal laws that dictate the rights of fiduciaries in this area, and those are the Stored Communications Act, which we abbreviate as SCA, and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And the Stored Communications Act is a part of a larger federal law known as the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And as a really general overview, this law protects against the unauthorized disclosure of certain types of electronic communication. So really, this is about disclosure. There are two sections to the law that really are important in this with respect to this conversation, and that's 18 United States Code, Section 2701A. And this section creates a criminal federal offense for anyone to intentionally access without authorization a facility through which an electronic communication service is provided. And then additionally, there's another section, and that's Section 2702, which prohibits an electronic communication service knowingly divulging the contents of a communication that is stored by the provider. However, disclosure is permitted with the lawful consent of the originator. And so we'll talk about consent later on and how that is a part of our planning process. And then additionally, the second federal law that I wanted to mention is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And very generally, this protects against the unauthorized use of protected computers. And it's worth noting that the United States Department of Justice takes the position that this act supports a criminal charge when anyone exceeds unauthorized use, and there's no exception in the law for a fiduciary that is trying to access digital assets. So that's really the federal law that is relevant here, kind of what I'll loosely refer to as kind of hacking laws, or laws that are aimed at criminalizing hacking and hacking-like solutions. So next, the federal law and the hacking laws are really important to understand, but the terms of service agreements on each website can't be forgotten. And so the homepage of virtually every commercial website has a link at the bottom of the page to the terms of service agreement, to the terms associated with that. And signing up for an account on a website or otherwise utilizing a website includes consenting to the terms that are in the terms of service agreement. And these really these contracts really dictate all of the different actions and the rights and obligations of the users, and basically everything that's going on the website. And really, these agreements typically address two major things, or at least, well, these agreements address a lot of things. But from my perspective, the two things that they're addressing that are important are when a user's rights are terminated and whether or not the user has the ability to transfer those rights to anyone else. And really what you often see in these agreements is that after a certain period of inactivity, then the account will automatically terminate. So really from an estate planning perspective, these terms of service agreements are really problematic. Many terms of service agreements expressly prohibit the transfer of an account and expressly prohibit parties from accessing an account during incapacity or at death. So just by way of example, I've included a couple just sample terms of service agreement excerpts that really have a bearing on this issue from an estate planning perspective. The Yahoo terms of service agreement provides that you agree that your Yahoo account is non-transferable and any rights to your Yahoo ID or contents within your account terminate upon your death. Upon receipt of a copy of a death certificate, your account may be terminated and all contents therein permanently. That we glean that there is not an option to transfer the user's rights. Facebook's terms of service provide that you will not share your password, let anyone else access your account, or do anything else that might jeopardize the security of your account. So another problem associated with terms of service agreements is that virtually no one reads them. And so there was a recent university study centered around a fake website, or I guess it was a real website, but they were fake terms of service included on the website, and the term said that anyone who uses the site agrees to have their data released to the NSA, and their firstborn child will be taken as payment for using the site. And despite that, 98% of people accepted the terms of use. So most people using sites don't really know what their rights are or what options they have. And then another issue that's at least worth mentioning that is a potential problem that comes from terms of service agreements is that many of them, for logical reasons, provide that they will be controlled and the relationships, the contractual relationships, are controlled by California law. So this will raise an interesting issue if the person using the site is domiciled or lives in another state and their digital property is there, and if they die there, which state's law will control with respect to the fiduciary having access to this information? Will it be where they live and where this digital asset is deemed to reside, or is it California? And I don't know the answer to that. And I think it would depend on other things, but it's just another issue. In 2002, states started kind of realizing, I think the issue had been realized much earlier, but states started addressing these access issues, and a few states, Connecticut, Delaware, Idaho, Indiana, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and Virginia, these were the states that were the very first to kind of attempt to tackle this digital property issue, and they enacted statutes that granted fiduciaries access to digital assets. And these states definitely deserve praise for being the very first to kind of tackle this issue, but what we found, or the reality of this, was that the laws that were enacted did not approach this issue in a comprehensive way. So just by way of example, Connecticut and Rhode Island enacted a statute that gave the personal representative under the will the access, the authority to access email, but only email. So everything else was not covered. Oklahoma and Idaho gave the personal representative the power to take control of, continue, or terminate just social networking accounts. Nevada gave the personal representative the power to direct the termination of online accounts, but no authority to access the accounts. Virginia enacted a statute that allowed a minor, with respect to a deceased minor, it gave a fiduciary an access to assume that minor's position with respect to terms of service agreements, but had no similar provision for adults. So the reality, the status quo in the early 2000s is that people, legislators were attempting to tackle this issue, but not in a uniform or in a complete way. So in an attempt to bring uniformity to this issue from a legal standpoint, the Uniform Law Commission developed a commission to create a uniform law in this area. And the drafting committee was, it consisted of members of the American Bar Association, the American Bankers Association, different groups, privacy groups and supporters. And so, excuse me, all of these individuals got together, and the result of their culminating effort was to create the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, UFADA, in 2015. And this law, it was considered by 27 legislatures, and out of all of those, only two states, Rhode Island and Tennessee, enacted a law that looked anything like the uniform law. And this law was very strongly opposed by providers and privacy groups like the ACLU. The major argument, as best I can tell, against the law was that it presumed that anyone using a site upon their death or incapacity wanted someone else to access the site. So it was very generous in giving fiduciaries the authority to access digital information. And so this led to kind of a renewed effort to try to make a uniform law, and the result of that in 2015, I may have misspoken, so the UFADA was in 2012, and then in 2015 we had RUFADA, the revised law, and has had a lot of success in being enacted, and so I'm going to talk about, to the extent we have time, I plan to talk in detail about the terms of that law. So I think next we're going to segue into some of the planning strategies that we use for digital assets. And the very first thing that should be mentioned and the very first step in planning for these assets is to create a digital asset inventory. And included in the materials, I included an Exhibit A, which is a digital asset inventory that we use with clients for this purpose. It's kind of the baseline of at least starting to think about all of the different accounts that you might have. If it would be helpful for anyone to have this in a Word, obviously this is something that has to be tailored to every single client, and this is really just the starting point, but if anybody would want a digital copy of this that could be edited for their own purposes, I would be more than happy to send it to you. I'm sure it can be recreated, but it's just something to get your brain churning about all of the different potential passwords and encryptions and websites that you use on a daily basis. So step one is really to try to convince a client, and in the estate planning context, that something like this should be created and that an enormous amount of time should be devoted to developing it. Step two, or really issue number two, is once created, where should you keep something like this? And there are a few options. I don't think there's any one option that makes the most sense for everyone. I think it's a case-by-case basis. One option would be to make a hard copy of the list and keep it in the safe deposit box. This might be the most secure place for it. It might be a logical place for people to look if upon your death, you know, everyone's going to look for things in a safe deposit box, and maybe that's where this should be. The major problem with that approach is that so difficult to update. And as you know, you're prompted to change your password all of the time. So ideally, this inventory needs to be somewhere where it's at least relatively easy for you to keep updated. Probably a slightly better option for where to keep an inventory or where we suggest clients keep them is you could have keep a digital inventory and have it secured by some kind of basic or, you know, a single password. This is obviously more flexible. It's less likely to be destroyed or lost. The obvious con or potential problem with this approach would be that you might accidentally lock out your fiduciary with your one password that's protecting all of your other information. Another option would be to keep a thumb drive that can be updated, but just put that somewhere really safe, like you would put anything that has value. I kind of like that approach. I mean, like I said, I'm not sure that there's a one-size-fits-all. There are also providers that exist that will kind of keep your passwords for you. One of those, and I haven't surveyed the industry by any means, and I don't know which one is the best. I happen to use LastPass. That's an option. It's free. Admittedly, I use it more to just stay organized and not lose my passwords than for a fiduciary planning. But in preparing for this presentation, I did tinker around, and I found that these providers and LastPass, just by way of example, has an option that allows you to designate people you trust, and you can name on the website somebody or a few people that could access this information. Mostly use this for organizational purposes, but the major problem that I would at least foresee with using a program like this for the purpose of protecting this or transferring this information to your future fiduciaries is that there's no guarantee that this companies will exist whenever it is that you ultimately die and become incapacitated. So, again, creating an inventory is really important. I have so many anecdotal stories of people who finding their parents or other individuals' digital inventories made their job just so much easier. And obviously, having all of that information in one place can make you very vulnerable if it's not kept in an appropriate place. But there's a balance here, and it seems that these things definitely do way more good than harm. So clients should also, or we also need to be apprised of what services and websites we use, when and where they allow us to, or they provide an online tool to name people to make these decisions, or to kind of take control of digital assets. I mentioned the LastPass people you trust type designation, but there are a lot of different providers that have this capability. By way of example, Google in 2013 launched a feature that they called the Inactive Account Manager, and it basically allows you to say what you want done with your account. You always have the opportunity to say that you want it terminated in certain circumstances. That's a reasonable desire. You can also choose the individual that you want to take control of the account. Facebook has something called, after your website's memorialized, a legacy contact. And this person can, I was just reading about it earlier, this person can pin things to your profile. They can respond to friend requests, which strikes me as but they can update certain aspects of your profile, and they can request the removal of your account. So they can shut it down and that's really kind of within their purview. There are always certain things. This is not something that allows someone to legally step into your account. So a person will never be able to log in as you or read messages or edit things that you've done in the past. So understanding when these things exist and when it makes sense for you to use them is important, and this will be highlighted when we talk about the uniform law, because what we will find and what we will talk about is when a provider has one of these types of online tools, this is controlling. This is the top of the, think of it like the POD on a bank account. You might have an estate planning document, but if POD goes to the pool boy gets that bank account. I mean, this is the new laws that are being put in place give legal authority to these different online tools. So moving forward, the next, you know, we also need to, from a planning perspective, deal with access to digital assets in powers of attorney instruments. And just by way of really general background, I know probably all of you are at least somewhat familiar with powers of attorney, but just to provide a little bit of background, powers of attorney are the documents that we routinely utilize to grant somebody the authority to make decisions for you when you're incapacitated. So the structure of the document is the person creating the power of attorney. We call that person the agent, We call that person the principal, and that person names someone else, whom we call the agent, to do certain things for them upon the principal's incapacity. So we have started, and the way that this document looks and the way that it functions is, you know, the principal's naming someone, and then there is a laundry list of different powers that are granted to the agent. And so we always specifically address the digital property issue in a power of attorney. This might be something that you might, those of you that have powers of attorney, this might be something that should be added or updated. But I've provided on the slide some sample language that we use. And I won't read through it there. I have it there in your materials, but it's really just really broad. You're granting your agent the authority to access XYZ, all of these different digital accounts. And then if you do look kind of to the bottom of the language, and all similar digital items which currently exist or may exist as technology develops. So this is the lawyerly attempt to include everything. And this is really the starting point language, that we would use. But if you have, you know, specific digital assets, this language should be tailored to make sure and include those. And so we also, I'll go back to the prior slide. We also include for the disposition of digital assets in estate planning documents. So one thing I wanted to mention, in addition to the power of attorney instrument, we have all of our clients sign we don't make our clients sign anything, but we encourage our clients to consider what we refer to as a digital asset authorization. And you'll find that on page 7 of the exhibit material. I'm not going to read this. You have it for your consideration. But ultimately, a couple of things I just want to point out about it. In paragraph 1, I wanted to point out, well, you see numbers 1, 2, and 3, where we're describing the property that's being released. The person signing this is releasing or consenting to access to any electronically stored information, contents of the communication in number 2, and then also the record of information. So what I'm getting at here is this is an authorization that's covering what I referred to at the beginning of the presentation as the content of electronic communication and really the catalog. So it's broad, and it needs to be broad, as we'll get to when we talk about the new law that's in place. The last thing I wanted to mention about this document, in the second paragraph, you can see that this specifically states that this authorization continues to be effective during any period that I'm incapacitated and continues to be effective after my death. That's important for clients that have a power of attorney. You may or may not know, a power of attorney is totally null and void upon death. So this is aimed at extending beyond death and being hopefully helpful to a fiduciary that's trying to access access digital assets after death. Now I think the one thing, just as an anecdote here, really the purpose of the planning stage, all of these steps, or at least these considerations, are to really help our clients identify what digital assets they have and what assets of sentimental value and real financial value, and to provide kind of a plan in place for the fiduciary to have all of the information they might need in one place. But lastly, and this might seem a little bit esoteric, but this type of we also want to make sure that if there's any litigation that might be going on at the time of death or any other controversy, that information can be accessed. And I think it's worth noting that the IRS is using electronically stored information to track people and their assets. And this is the reality that we're experiencing. And so IRS manuals are telling their agents to look at taxpayers' online account activities, review social media. In 2011, a chief counsel advice memorandum was released that advised that IRS agents can summon a taxpayer's electronic metadata, which, as you probably know, is really significant because that includes when things were edited and who has accessed that information and the time frame for that. And you might be thinking, you know, this estate tax exemption is so high, what's the likelihood of this being relevant? But lots of clients have income tax related issues going on at or near the time of death. And so one aspect of planning is making sure, to the extent that the objective and the requirement is that the fiduciary control this so that it can be released appropriately, either in a litigation context or in any other context, planning is important. Otherwise, it could be lost. I want to talk a little bit about RUFADA, which I mentioned earlier as the revised uniform fiduciary, the revised uniform fiduciary access to digital assets act. And so this particular law has been introduced in 44 states, and now 37 have turned it into law. Missouri, as we'll discuss later, Missouri is not one of them. Kansas is. I know that there are people on the call from other jurisdictions. I have a slide in the materials that shows enactment in other jurisdictions, and we'll talk about that. But really, one of the key differences between the old law and the new law is that this law requires a user to consent to his or her fiduciary accessing this information. And this consent can be granted in one of two places, in the online tool that I mentioned earlier or in estate planning documents. And RUFADA is also beneficial in that it provides exactly how the custodian is required to release this information when an appropriate request is made. So I'm not going to go through all of the provisions of RUFADA, but there are several that I do want to discuss. So the first couple sections are not too exciting. Title and definitions. Section 3 is important. This is a difference between the old and the new law. This section makes clear that this law is not talking about any assets that are owned by an employer where the employee is using them. So that's totally outside the context of this realm, and this new law has done a good job of clarifying this. Section 3, that same section, also makes sure that the Act applies to the provider of digital assets if the user resided in a state where this is enacted or resided there at the time of death. This particular slide that I have deals with the next section, sections 4 and 5. And these, at least in my opinion, are the most important provisions, or perhaps the most noteworthy provisions of the law. And these sections give internet users the power to plan for the management and the disposition of digital assets, similar to as they would with tangible assets. And in the case of conflicting instructions, which I talked about earlier in the presentation, is, you know, we have federal law, we have state law, we have these terms of service agreements. This law, one of the major contributions, at least in my mind, is that it provides a hierarchy for how to approach those conflicting instructions. So at the top, if the custodian provides an online tool and that this tool needs to be separate from the terms of service agreement that allows the user to name another person to have access to the user's digital content, RUFATA makes it clear that these user online tools are legally enforceable. And so next, if the custodian doesn't provide, or the online service provider doesn't have this online tool, or if the user, it existed but the user never used it, then in that case, the user can give legally enforceable instructions in the form of their estate plan. By way of example, the consent document that I shared with you. And ultimately, what the law provides, that if the user hasn't used an online tool and the user has not addressed this in the form of estate planning documents, then in that case, the terms of service will control. And then if there aren't any terms of service, then the just default rules of RUFATA control. So this hierarchy is tremendously helpful and is probably one of the defining features and contributions of this law. The next section sets forth the possible, I mentioned that this law also tells the custodian exactly what they need to do by way of releasing information. So under the law, the custodian has discretion to grant the fiduciary full access to the account, or they can grant some limited access if they deem that that's all that's necessary for the fiduciary to perform whatever duties they're trying to perform, access the account, or really whatever their objective is. And then the law also provides that if the request is unduly burdensome, then the provider can get directions from a court as to clarifying the method of production. Sections 7 and 8 are also very important. And Section 7 sets forth the rules for disclosure of protected electronic communication. So within the realm, what I'm talking about here is the content of digital assets. So this section provides that if the user consented to disclosure of electronic contents, or if a court directs disclosure, the content of the electronic communication will be released, but the personal representative needs to provide a written request for the disclosure, certified copy of death certificate, the document granting that person authority, so that might be the letters testamentary issued by the court. And unless the user has utilized the online tool, the personal representative also needs to have a legal document granting that person authority to access the content. The next section sets forth the disclosure requirements for non-protected digital assets. So in this, I'm talking about the catalog of electronic communications, so the data of when things were received and all of the information related to that. And what this section provides is that unless the user prohibited disclosure of digital assets, or the court directs otherwise, a custodian shall disclose to the PR the catalog of electronic communications. And additionally, the user is required to say, and by the way, there is this other information that you're not even haven't made inquiry about. So what we see here, kind of to recap, it's a lot of to sort through the actual provisions. But really what's important here is that these two sections are trying to balance the user's privacy interest with a fiduciary's need to administer the estate. And it's drawing this distinction between the law is treating electronic information that is content and electronic information that is a catalog different. That's the slide is an attempt to simplify the language of the statute. I won't go through the other provisions of the Act carry out this general theme, which is balancing privacy and content and acknowledging that some users do not want this information released. So the subsequent sections deal with this from, I just read the provisions that, or summarized the provisions that are with respect to a personal representative, but there's this similar approach in dealing with releasing assets to an agent under a power of attorney, a trustee, or successor trustee. And I'll move forward to the enactment map, that this shows kind of where we are as of this week on enacting this statute. This is what we call an overlay statute. So it's designed to work with all different jurisdictions, probate codes and existing trust codes and things of that nature. It's really all about, the bottom line, I think, of this statute is that it aims to give the user the ability to control what they want terminated, what they want released. And so where we are, at least in Missouri, you'll notice that it has not been passed yet. This law was introduced last year, and it was passed by both the Missouri House and the Senate, but then the governor vetoed the bill, and I pulled the veto letter, and Greitens' primary argument against the bill was that it violated the Missouri Constitution's language that no bill shall contain more than one subject which shall be clearly expressed in its title. It was misleading about digital assets, but there were multiple things in this bill, and that created an issue. This has been reintroduced in 2018, and I think, at least from my perspective, I'm hopeful that it'll be enacted. I think it's helpful. As you can see, it's had a lot of traction in a lot of different states. So, lastly, I want to just briefly talk about some issues related to administering an estate with digital assets. So historically, whenever a fiduciary, a personal representative, or trustee has been appointed, the process has been for the fiduciary and his or her attorney to kind of search through the decedent's house, their papers, their business, to watch the mail for a 90-day cycle, review tax returns, and now in a digital world, this just isn't getting the job done because people's bills are electronic and they're paying, I pay bills by text message. I don't know how secure that is, but the reality is that's how we're operating. And so watching the mail at my house would do nothing for whoever's trying to administer my estate. But so the way that we deal with this has to change, and the very first step for a fiduciary is to make an immediate inventory of digital assets. So to the extent that the decedent did that during their lifetime, that's an enormous step, and a lot of, hopefully, the work is done, but whether or not the planning's been done, that's the reality. That needs to happen immediately. And the fiduciary needs to get access to the decedent's computer and any other digital equipment that they're using. Depending on the amount of digital property that a decedent has, there are some additional steps that may or may not, you know, need to be considered. One of those is to make a backup of the original data before beginning any search. There are consultants that are assisting with this and have really kind of capitalized on this unique narrow area. I mentioned this before, but if there is a current or potential law enforcement investigation going on, it's really important that the fiduciary not do take any steps that could be viewed as, or accidentally perhaps, viewed as an obstruction of justice. So in situations like this, and I mean, this happens. It seems very unique, but lots of people die in car accidents, and those estates have to be administered, and so this is, at least in my mind, something that comes up and I've seen come up. But in a case like that, you would want to make sure that you're not attempting to power on assets or, you know, immediately access these things. And it might be prudent to make a copy of the record in that case. Another step that the fiduciary might consider as far as safeguarding digital property is to notify online account providers of a death or of an incapacity, and really try to, that next step is ascertaining, was there an online tool, was it utilized? Next, what does the terms of service provide, and what are my potential missteps under those terms? And especially now in Missouri, I mentioned that we have this hierarchy, not in Missouri, we don't have, not yet anyway, so it's really important to not accidentally violate a federal hacking law while you're trying to figure out how your parents handled their brokerage account. Another step that's important is assigning value to digital assets. We have to do this because if there's a probate estate, we need to file an inventory with the court. If the client has a taxable estate, we need to prepare and file a federal estate tax return. So valuing this digital property can be pretty complicated. Depending on if you're doing it for tax purposes or if you're doing it for probate purposes, you can look at kind of attempt to see what other things of similar natures are selling for on eBay or other marketplaces. There are comparables. I think lastly what I want to just mention are just some of the areas to keep an eye out for, or some of the places where we see valuable digital assets. And probably the most common of significant or potentially significant value is intellectual property that's been created by the decedent. Intellectual property is typically valued by looking at recent revenue streams and alongside the forecasted future revenue streams. We see this kind of come up with blogs and online advertising. Domain names can be tremendously valuable. In 2004, the domain name beer.com sold for $7 million. The domain name sex.com sold for $13 million in 2010. And then the final kind of type of asset that I at least wanted to mention is virtual currency. This is just really kind of all very recent. I mean, 2017 was the first year that we really saw cryptocurrencies become an investment for the masses. And Bitcoin is now traded on two U.S. derivative exchanges, CBOE and the CME, and it's being traded in the form of Bitcoin future contracts. And so it's really difficult to tell how many people are using this. As I mentioned before, one of the defining features of a cryptocurrency is that there is no uniform, or it's all anonymous. I mean, you can use whatever information you want to create a Bitcoin wallet. And this creates really difficult issues from a planning standpoint, because unlike a checking or a savings account, if there's, you know, not a beneficiary designation, you can go to the provider and find out what they need to effectuate the transfer of this. But with Bitcoin and it being, and other cryptocurrencies, with them being anonymous, nobody will know that you owned Bitcoin, and nobody will be able to access it or retain that value if you don't tell someone that you owned it. And not only that, but give them all of the PIN information associated with it. Another thing to mention, most states have enacted some sort of version of the Prudent Investor Act, which controls how assets in an estate or a trust need to be prudently invested. And so to the extent there are people that have large amounts of cryptocurrencies, to the extent that they want it to be kept and not diversified, then that would need to be very expressly laid out in estate planning documents. So I think I'll leave on the note of Bitcoins, although I'm that it's an area that if there are questions about that or any other issue that I've talked about, I'm happy to answer them either now while we're on the call or if there are questions from other offices. Otherwise, you're welcome to ask me questions kind of after the session concludes. I will, if I don't know the answer, I will find out and get back with you.
So we'll go ahead and open it up for any general questions.
So my question is on the regarding your digital estate information list. You've mentioned a couple alternatives for that. What do you see any pros or cons of it? What is as a financial advisor and as a tax return preparer, if we kept that for people and then provided it to the fiduciaries appropriately, since we see these people at least regularly, and to try to encourage them to update? What do you think of that?
I think, so the question for other people in other offices is, on the issue of creating the digital inventory, what's the best place to keep it? And the question is it appropriate or is it advisable for either the attorney or the financial advisor to perhaps keep it? And I think there are lawyers that I work with that do keep this information in the file. And as you suggest, I think the benefit of that is it's a reminder to update it with other things. And it's also a safe place. Obviously, the fiduciary, at least in an estate planning context, we're the first. The whole file is going to be a treasure trove of information that's going to be helpful. I think that's a good place for it. I think that to the extent you are comfortable having this information and you're willing to do that for your clients, I think that would be a logical place to keep it. I get my law firm, for example, we do not have a vault like some law firms do, and so we have everything is locked and secure, and original documents are locked, but I think I have some digital inventories. I usually suggest that clients like that, we suggest that they keep their originals, that they keep them, but I think to the extent that you're willing to do that and you have the secure or the online, I know a lot of financial advisors have I'm sending estate planning documents to be uploaded to a portal that is literally everything. And clients love, it seems to me like, you know, a lot of people are like, send my documents here so everything's in the same place, and that's great. That would probably be a really wonderful place to keep it. So I know, I think that's a great question. I probably don't have a perfect answer, but I think it's totally reasonable and a to keep this information for your clients.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and end. Thank you very much, Alice. We greatly appreciate your time today.